Let's finish up this unit. We were talking about the second part of gene expression. What's that second part overall called? Translation. That is the part that does not involve DNA, right? DNA's job's already done. It was involved in transcription. The transcript now exists, or the code, I should say, now exists in the form of the mRNA transcript, whose job it is to instruct the ribosome how to actually assemble the polypeptide, which means telling that ribosome how many amino acids to use, which ones to use, and in which order. And how does the ribosome know which ones to use? Which amino acids to use? By the codons, which are part of the genetic code, right? The genetic code is that universal set of codons that all organisms use. So a codon means a specific amino acid. Every time that codon is read, it means the same amino acid, because the genetic code is not ambiguous. It is redundant, but it's not ambiguous. So we've already looked at slide 12 a little bit, and really, we'll look at the particulars of this in a second, but the important thing here, as a way of transitioning into the next slide, is that we're involving multiple kinds of RNA, right? We've already mentioned messenger RNA. That, of course, is a type of RNA. That's the transcript, the red part here. Where else is there RNA, though? There's tRNA, which are all the teal ones that are shown here, multiple different tRNAs, which is transfer RNA. And where else?
mRNA?
Well, we just said that. That's the red one.
RRNA?
Right. There's rRNA, ribosomal RNA, along with protein, making up the actual stuff of the ribosomal complexes, of which there are two. Okay, let's go to 13 then and take a closer look at transfer RNA. tRNA is denoted in cartoon form in this chapter as these teal bent rods. But of course, molecularly speaking, it's an RNA, like any other kind of RNA. And remember that unlike DNA, which is typically a double-stranded nucleic acid consisting of two polynucleotides held together by hydrogen bonding, an RNA is typically a single strand. So it is one molecule. Remember I said that technically speaking, a DNA is really two molecules, because you can think of each polynucleotide strand as its own molecule. Well, an RNA has only one strand, whether it's messenger RNA, tRNA, or any other kind of RNA. Here we're looking at a tRNA in kind of schematic form at the top. Here we can see that it indeed is an end-to-end arrangement of nucleotides like you'd expect for a polynucleotide. But notice that it, even though it's all one strand, it wraps back around on itself multiple times, forming three hairpin loops, as they're called, in this overall cloverleaf pattern, or the three-leafed clover at least. And the reason it's able to wrap back around and form hydrogen bonds with itself is because there is complementarity in certain sections when it is folded, and that holds it, that gives it its structural integrity. Of those three hairpin loops, the second of them, the middle of the three, which is the bottom of the figure at the top here, is the important one in terms of information, carrying information. And that, notice that it features three nucleotides. Now, every one of these letters, of course, is a nucleotide, because the whole thing is a polynucleotide, an RNA molecule. But it's really these three nucleotides that give this particular tRNA its specific function. And those three nucleotides collectively make up what we call an anticodon, so named because it is complementary to a certain codon. Right? The codons make up the genetic code. And what are the codons made out of?
Amino acids?
No. The codons specify amino acids, but they're not made out of amino acids. What are the codons actually made out of? They are part of a nucleic acid, but what's each codon made out of?
Three mRNA nucleotides.
Right. Codons are part of messenger RNA, not shown here. The anticodon, or an anticodon, is a complementary 3 RNA nucleotide sequence on a different kind of RNA, a transfer RNA molecule. But it's called an anticodon because it is exactly complementary to a certain codon that mRNA can carry, and that therefore corresponds to a certain amino acid according to the genetic code, right? So tRNA's overall job is to bring in to the ribosome, the machine that's building the protein, to bring in the appropriate kind of amino acid that's needed next, when the next codon gets read. You know, there's however many codons long the mRNA is however many amino acids are eventually going to be assembled. But at any given moment in that process, the ribosome is going to be reading one current codon. And that calls for one specific amino acid, right? Because of the non-ambiguity of the genetic code. So when it's reading a codon to put the appropriate amino acid onto the growing strand correctly, it needs to call the correct kind of tRNA that's carrying just that kind of amino acid. So there are many different kinds of tRNA because there are many different codons in the genetic code. Right? There are 64 codons, but 4 of them do special duty. 61 of them code for amino acids, though, right? So there are many different kinds of tRNA corresponding to these codons, because each individual kind of tRNA features a specific anticodon that only corresponds complementarily to one codon. All right? So just as there are multiple codons in messenger RNA, you have to have multiple different kinds of tRNA corresponding to them. That's what the anticodon is all about. Now, at the top of the figure is where both ends of the single strand are, since it wraps it around on itself. Notice that the 3 prime and the 5 prime end are both at that kind of the stem of the clover. The 3 prime end, which sticks out a little farther, as you see, that's important because that 3 prime end is where the connection can be made between this thing, which is an RNA molecule, a tRNA, and the thing that it's able to carry, which is an amino acid. All right? But for all of this to work well, for the information to remain intact, and for the correct protein to be assembled, each individual kind of tRNA can only be allowed to carry one kind of amino acid. Specifically, the kind of amino acid that is specified in the genetic code by a codon in mRNA that is complementary to the tRNA's own anticodon. Does that all make sense? So if you look up in the genetic code what is complementary to this AAG, whatever amino acid that is, and I don't have it memorized, would be the only kind of amino acid that this particular kind of tRNA would be allowed to carry at its 3 prime end. Because that way, when the codon for that amino acid comes up in the messenger RNA at the ribosome, this will be the only kind of tRNA allowed in, and therefore the correct kind of amino acid will be brought in. That's really crucial for maintaining the integrity of the information and therefore creating the correct kind of protein, which is itself very crucial, because if you don't make the right primary sequence, then you don't have the right secondary sequence when it folds up, and then the right tertiary sequence. In other words, you make a protein with the wrong shape, and it therefore will not work for whatever job it's supposed to do, because shape gives proteins their function. Okay, so just to make it easier to look at, this is a two-dimensional view. Molecularly, it's not this. You have to spread it out into a plane in order to look at it like this. But when you allow it to have its natural three-dimensional shape, a tRNA, roughly speaking, has this bent rod shape, which is why we simplify it in cartoon form like this. And even though the whole thing is a sequence of nucleotides, we don't care what that sequence is except for these three that make up the anticodon, because that's the one that determines the kind of amino acids it's allowed to carry. Now, last time, I ended by saying that overall there's two major categories of tRNA based on whether or not they're carrying something. And what are those categories?
Charged and uncharged.
A charged tRNA is simply a tRNA that is attached to at least one amino acid at its 3' end. An uncharged one is what we see here. This is just the tRNA. It's not carrying anything. All right? But remember, I just said that a charged means it's carrying at least one. So there's two possibilities for just charged tRNAs. One possibility is that that charged tRNA is carrying exactly one amino acid. And what do we call that in that case? What's the general name for any kind of tRNA if it's carrying just one amino acid? The name makes perfect sense. Right, an aminoacyl tRNA. That's one kind of charged tRNA, because it's carrying at least one, right? But it has to be exactly one for it to be an aminoacyl tRNA, because the thing it's carrying is an amino acid. If it's carrying two or more, then it's not a single amino acid. It's a peptide of some size, right? And therefore, we call that charged kind, that kind of charged tRNA, a peptidyl tRNA. All right. So those are the three categories overall. Uncharged tRNAs, aminoacyl tRNAs, and peptidyl tRNAs. Okay, peptidyl tRNAs are carrying two or more, at least two, though, amino acids. Keep that in mind when we talk about them again. But first, let's go to slide 14 and talk about how an uncharged tRNA comes to be an aminoacyl tRNA. In other words, a charged tRNA carrying just one amino acid. First of all, there's all kinds of these different tRNAs because they have different anticodons, right? And there's many, many copies of each one. So there's millions and millions of tRNAs in the cell. And just as a general, there's always a pool of tRNAs available in the cytosol, because that's, remember, where translation takes place, even in a eukaryote, right? Transcription took place in the nucleus. Translation takes place out in the cytoplasm, in the liquid component, which is the cytosol. So there's this general pool of tRNA of all different kinds, each with, all the different kinds of anticodons are represented. They're not really doing anything when they're uncharged, right? They can't help in the process of translation unless they are charged, because their job is to carry the amino acid to the ribosome. But each individual kind of tRNA needs to be correctly charged. You would, once again, mess up that information and end up making the wrong protein if you stuck the wrong amino acid on to an uncharged tRNA. You have to make sure that it gets charged with the amino acid that it's allowed to carry and that corresponds to its anticodon. To do that requires the help of an enzyme, not surprisingly. And it's the grayish one here that kind of looks like an embryo in shape in this cartoon form. The name of the enzyme, as you see, is aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. Now, gets the name synthetase because to synthesize means to bring together things. So what's being synthesized or brought together here is an uncharged tRNA and its kind of amino acid that it's allowed to carry. Right? The enzyme brings them together. You can see that there's just the right shape for them. And it shouldn't surprise you at this point in the course that doing this is going to be an expensive process. Right? You're making a bigger thing, a charged aminoacyl tRNA, out of two smaller things, an amino acid and an uncharged tRNA. So that's going to cost you some energy. That's why we have energy being used here, ATP. So notice that the ATP is spent kind of activating the aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzyme with the amino acid first, loading it with that amino acid. And therefore, the rest of the process is allowing the right kind of tRNA to come in that's allowed to carry that amino acid and pick it up. How is it that the enzyme knows which kind of tRNA to let in there? Because there's a correspondence between the anticodon and a sequence in the protein that is the enzyme. This means, or it implies, maybe you got the implication, that just like there are different kinds of tRNAs, there are also different kinds of tRNA, aminoacyl tRNA synthetases. So it's not just one universal enzyme. Each enzyme is responsible for charging its own kind of tRNA. All right, so all of this specificity maintains the information, ensuring that when you finally do assemble the sequence of amino acids that is the polypeptide, the final product of translation, it's the correct one and therefore will operate for whatever kind of job that protein is designed for or has evolved for. All right, so once the charging takes place, once the bond is formed between the amino acid and the 3' end of the formerly uncharged tRNA, now it's a charged tRNA, then it gets released from the enzyme just like you'd expect the product to do, right? And that allows this aminoacyl tRNA synthetase to do the same thing to another pair of the same kinds of particles. It's only that kind of tRNA and only that kind of amino acid. Similarly, the rest of the aminoacyl tRNA synthetases are busy doing exactly the same thing, but to other kinds of tRNA. So that means, independently of translation, which involves that ribosome, you have these enzymes working continuously, charging the uncharged tRNAs with their appropriate amino acids. And therefore, you have, at any given moment, at the ready, many copies of charged tRNAs carrying all 20 kinds of amino acids, right? You know what I mean. There's 20 different kinds, each carrying its own kind of amino acid. So whenever a codon comes up and you need that kind of amino acid, you already have it ready to go. All right? Well, where do the uncharged tRNAs come from? Why are they uncharged to begin with? They're uncharged, or they become uncharged, I should say, because when they drop their amino acid off to the ribosome, they come out eventually off of that process uncharged, because the amino acids get delivered to the growing chain. And so the uncharged tRNAs then have to go back to find the correct kind of enzyme and get charged again so they can be reused. Let's look at that process in slide 15. The two ribosomal complexes, or subunits, I mean, large and small, are shown here together. But remember, that's a lie. They're not actually together until a messenger RNA has already been there. And we'll look at that process in a second as well. But for now, when you look at the middle one, which is the same thing as the top picture, it's just that the top picture doesn't give you really as clear a picture. This kind of shows you more a realistic shape. but the cartoon form is really the best. You notice that the large subunit features three conspicuous slots in its on its surface, labeled here as E, P, and A. I read it that way because we're used to, in English at least, reading left to right. But actually, that's the reverse of the order in which these slots are used in the process of translation. It's A and then P and then E, really. Now, obviously those must stand for something since it's not just A, B, C. And they do stand for something. The A slot, as you see, is short for aminoacyl tRNA binding site. In other words, that's where an aminoacyl tRNA will come in, carrying its one amino acid by definition. Otherwise, it wouldn't be an aminoacyl tRNA, right? The middle slot is the P slot, which is short for peptidyl tRNA binding site. Now, it's not that a peptidyl tRNA comes into that P slot. It's just that a tRNA that enters that P slot becomes a peptidyl tRNA, and I'll explain why that makes sense in a second. But all the tRNAs that come from outside of the ribosome come in as aminoacyl tRNAs and therefore enter the A slot. The E is short for exit. And so before they exit, each tRNA passes the amino acids that it's carrying to the next incoming tRNA, and that changes that that E slot tRNA into an uncharged DNA, right? tRNA, because it has given up all of its amino acids to the next one. That makes it, by definition, an uncharged tRNA, and that's why it's now ready to be ejected from the exit site for the E slot. That's what I was talking about earlier when I said the uncharged tRNAs come out of the ribosome because they've already passed their amino acids on to something else. And they then have to be recharged so that their codon comes up again, they'll be ready. All right, let's look at this process then. Well, actually, before we leave this picture, because I think this might be the best view of this. Oh, no, it actually isn't the best view, so never mind what I said. Let's go on to slide 16. Remember that there were three phases of transcription, which is not what we're looking at here. We're looking at translation here. But I'm asking you to think back to transcription. What are the three phases?
Initiation, elongation, termination.
That's right. Initiation, elongation, termination, exactly the same names, even though different things are happening, for translation. Translation consists of the three phases that are exactly named for transcriptional phases. Here we're looking at initiation. And here, finally, you get the truth in terms of what's happening with the ribosomal subunits. The small and the large have never met, and they're modular, so when they do meet, it might be the only time they ever are together, because one small can join up with any other large. I mean, with any large. They're all modular. But anyway, the ribosome doesn't really exist as a whole until you have both subunits, and that doesn't happen until first the messenger RNA, and this is the mature mRNA, if we're talking about a eukaryotic organism, so it's already been modified, or if it's in a bacterium, which is not a eukaryote, of course, then it's mature to begin with. But in any case, it's a ready-to-go messenger RNA. It has to first bind to the small ribosomal subunit. And this is what one of those untranslated regions I was talking about, UTRs, help out in. The UTRs don't contain codons that will specify amino acids because they're upstream of the first codon. They're kind of like the film leader that I was talking about. They are necessary, though, to recognize the place on the small ribosomal subunit to allow this messenger RNA to bind to it. And when it does so, that positions it perfectly so that the first codon, which is the start codon, and you remember what that is? AUG. So that AUG is positioned perfectly in the position where the P slot will be once the large subunit comes along as well. Okay? So this is untranslated region. This is the P slot, and AUG is this codon in the messenger RNA. Now, for AUG to bind complementarily to a tRNA, it needs one specific anticodon, right? Which is UAC. Therefore, that's the only kind of tRNA that can come along, and that binds next after the messenger RNA does. All right? And since AUG is the start codon, UAC is the complementary anticodon, that means it's always this kind of tRNA that comes in there. And since AUG comes in there first, and since AUG is not only the start codon, but also does double duty as coding for methionine, specifically, that amino acid, then it's always methionine that comes in as the first amino acid. All polypeptides start with methionine as the first amino acid, even if it shouldn't be there, simply because that's the start codon. And if it's not really supposed to be there in terms of a design, then it will be cleaved off later. That's part of post-translational modification. It has to start, though, with methionine. Once that's all in place, then at the expense of a GTP molecule, which does exactly the same job as ATP, except it's using guanosine instead of adenosine as the nucleoside, so it's a guanosine triphosphate. Its hydrolysis, or removal of phosphate, turns it into GTP, but the release of energy allows for the completion of what we call this whole thing, the translation initiation complex, which consists of both ribosomal subunits, so the big one comes along too, the mRNA, the tRNA that has an anticodon corresponding to the start codon, and the amino acid that tRNA is carrying. And since it's only that one amino acid, that specifically is an aminoacyl tRNA. So I just told you a little bit ago that the P slot is named for peptidyl tRNA. This is the only exception to that. It comes in as an aminoacyl tRNA and gets put into the P slot. It's not a peptidyl tRNA. But once we get into the next step, which is the repetitive elongation phase, it's always going to be a peptidyl tRNA that's there. All right? So that is one expense of energy. Now, building the polypeptide is going to be very expensive, right? Because you're making a very big polymer. But it's not just all one expense of GTP. Much GTP gets spent. This is just the first of many that have to be spent. There's going to have to be GTP spent for every single amino acid that's added. Anyway, that's initiation. Let's go to 17 and look at the cyclic representation of elongation. And it's cyclic because in elongation, it's just the same thing is happening over and over for however long the polypeptide is going to be, right? However many codons there are. And in fact, we've already gone into the process a little bit, so we skipped ahead a little bit since there's already some amino acids that have been added. Notice, though, that this one that is in the P slot is properly now called a peptidyl tRNA. How did it get to be a peptidyl tRNA is the question to be answered now. Notice that the A slot is at the moment empty. The A slot is always where the current codon is being read after initiation. So the very first part of elongation is to read that A slot codon, which is going to correspond the first time to the second amino acid, right? And then it's going to correspond to the third amino acid and so on as the mRNA gets shifted one codon, which means three nucleotides with respect to the ribosome. So it's kind of like film going through the part that projects it. But in any case, it's whatever is positioned at the A slot, that's what I refer to when I say the current codon that's being read. That's the A slot. Okay, and because of strict complementarity, whatever that codon is going to allow just the right kind of anticodon-bearing tRNA into that A slot. And remember, it's called an A slot for amino acyl tRNA, so it's not just any tRNA. I mean, it's not only a tRNA with the right anticodon, it's a charged tRNA with the right codon, and even more specifically than that, an amino acyl tRNA carrying just one amino acid. Okay? So that's how the next correct amino acid gets into the whole complex, the whole translation complex. But now this red arrow is important because here you can see how an amino acyl tRNA becomes a peptidyl tRNA. All right? What happens is that the however many amino acids are being carried by the P slot tRNA at the moment, all of those amino acids get transferred to the one amino acid that's already being carried by the A slot tRNA. And they're put on the far end of the amino acid. Okay? So that means now this one that's in the A slot and therefore should be an amino acyl tRNA, at the moment is going to be a peptidyl tRNA. Which means it's in the wrong slot now, right? But it's not going to last very long because immediately then there's going to be a shift of position with respect to the ribosome's relationship to the messenger RNA. The messenger RNA will be fed through the ribosomal subunits by one codon, placing the former A slot tRNA in the P slot. This one's going to be here then, which you see right there, which is now appropriate as far as names are concerned because it is a peptidyl tRNA, right? But the one that was the former peptidyl tRNA has now transferred all of its amino acids to the new one, and therefore that former peptidyl tRNA is now an uncharged tRNA. And it gets put into the E slot, which is appropriate for an uncharged tRNA, and it gets ejected. Well, notice that GTP was needed in two places in what I just described. And that's going to bring you back to the position that you really start with in this cycle. Once you eject and the A slot is empty again, it can receive the new one corresponding to the new codon that's being read. So you already spent a GTP for initiation. You spend two GTPs for every single amino acid after that that you add just for elongation. And there can be thousands in one protein. One polypeptide. All right, that's elongation. Termination is shown in 18. And it's kind of the same thing as elongation, except obviously termination is going to involve a stop codon, right? That's the big difference. The reason that the translation complex knows that it's time for termination is simply that the currently read codon is suddenly one of the three stop codons. And it doesn't matter which of the three. They all operate exactly the same way. When a stop codon comes up to the A slot, there is no corresponding kind of tRNA. Because remember, unlike the start codon, stop codons do not also code for amino acids. So there is no tRNA corresponding to any of the three stop codons. Instead, there's a special kind of protein, not an RNA at all. It's a protein, which you should kind of know from the word factor. We use the word factor often to refer to different kinds of proteins in cells. Specifically, it's called a release factor. So when a stop codon, any one of the three, is encountered, instead of a tRNA coming into the A slot, it's a release factor that comes into the RNA. And that serves as a signal to the whole complex that you've already added the last amino acid that was needed, In other words, the polypeptide is already complete. It's still attached to the P-slot peptidyl tRNA, but it's already done in terms of adding amino acids. So it's time for us to disintegrate as a complex, is what the release factor tells it. And that, therefore, the completed polypeptide is released from the tRNA, turning it from a peptidyl tRNA into an uncharged one, and it gets released. The polypeptide, by the way, is done in terms of translation, but like I said earlier, it might need some modification still, but translation is done in terms of that polypeptide. And the two ribosomal complex, ribosomal subunits come apart, the release factor comes apart, and the messenger RNA gets detached from the subunits. Now, what we have just done is make one polypeptide. It's almost never the case that a single polypeptide gets produced, because we're talking about inside a cell, there are literally millions of different molecules just in one microscopic cell. So when you talk about making a protein, you're really making thousands or millions of copies of that protein. They'll be exact copies, though, because if you keep using the same code for the same sequence of codons, the same messenger RNA transcript, in other words, then you'll keep making the same sequence of amino acids. All right? What I'm saying here is that even though this particular translation complex has disintegrated, the messenger RNA is still intact. And as long as it's still intact, the same thing can happen again. Two subunits can come along and start initiation at the start codon again, and you'll make another exact copy of that same protein. So messenger RNA is reusable, and in fact will be reused as long as it still exists as an intact molecule, which means it could run into problems, because you don't want to make any protein that you don't need. You don't want to keep making a protein after you no longer need the protein, because whatever job it does might interfere, you know, if you want that job to be done. But also you don't want to build stuff that's expensive to build. It's going to waste your energy, making you less likely to continue to live. So control of translation is a really important thing in cells. And it's done different ways, but one way it's done is that no individual messenger RNA molecule lasts very long. It'll last for some time, but eventually the cell will destroy it on purpose so that the cell won't keep making proteins that the messenger RNA codes for. Now, why is it not a problem to destroy that messenger RNA? Why should the cell not be afraid? Even if it makes a mistake and says, actually, I needed that protein after all, why is it not a problem that it destroyed the messenger RNA? You can make more, and why can you make more? Code where? Right, that's what the gene is for. Each protein coding gene is a manual in the library for how to construct one particular messenger RNA, right? Or actually, maybe multiple kinds if you do alternative splicing like I was talking about. But in any case, you can always go back to the library and build another messenger RNA if you need that protein again. And when you do that, you're not going to let that messenger RNA hang around forever either. So you're always going to have to go back to the gene. You don't just transcribe a gene one time and then for the whole lifetime of the cell. You're going to have to use it over and over. Okay, notice, by the way, that even termination requires GTP. So it's an expensive process building a polypeptide, but that shouldn't be surprising. All right, now to 19. We're done with the translation process, but a few more slides left. What we're looking at here, as you see labeled with the bracket there, is a polyribosome. And it's something that can occur in both a eukaryotic cell or a prokaryotic cell. But as the name implies, a polyribosome, meaning many ribosomes, is a single messenger RNA transcript, the one piece of red that you see there, and multiple different ribosomes simultaneously translating that single messenger RNA, but they're doing it at different parts in the process. They're attached to different parts of it. Right? If you think of the messenger RNA as being strung through the ribosomal subunits to be read, that means once they come out, that messenger RNA could be read again, right? As soon as you have enough strung out of the first ribosome, then you have room for another ribosome to clamp on there. The point here is that you don't have to wait until that ribosome reaches the very end of the messenger RNA to start the process again. So that's why you have in purple different copies. They're all copies, though identical copies, of the same kind of polypeptide being built at different stages. The one on the left got started most recently because this is the start codon, and that's why it's shortest. It's added the fewest of the amino acids so far. This one's added more, and so it's longer. This one is already complete, and so it's going to hit that release factor and disintegrate. But however many ribosomes are on that single piece of messenger RNA at the same time, those and the messenger RNA collectively make up the polyribosome. So it's a really efficient way of doing things, right? No need to wait. So not only does a single messenger RNA allow for multiple copies of the same protein to be translated, but also, when it comes to transcription, before this happened, a single gene can be transcribed multiple times in a short time, making multiple copies of messenger RNA, each of which can become a polyribosome. So you can really ramp up production, make a lot of protein at once, all identical, because of the genetic code. All right, now to 20. When we were in the tour of the cell chapter, when we looked at different organelles, that's when we first talked about ribosomes. And back then I said that even though, molecularly speaking, all ribosomes within the same cell are the same, they're indistinguishable from each other, there are two classifications, which are free ribosomes and bound ribosomes. You remember talking about this? What is a bound ribosome? Or no, actually, let's start with free. What's a free ribosome? Floating around where?
In the cytoplasm.
In other words, it's not attached to anything other than the things we just talked about for translation. Free ribosome is on its own. It's not connected to a membrane. A bound ribosome, on the other hand, is bound to the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, and specifically the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which is why it's called rough, right? Each ribosome looks like a little stud on the surface. Well, the process I just talked about, at least the beginning of translation, that initiation and the beginning of elongation, that always happens in the cytosol on a free ribosome. All translation starts out on a free ribosome. Some translation actually ends in the cytosol as well. So for certain polypeptides, they're created entirely in the cytosol. And that makes sense for those kinds of polypeptides because whatever job they do, they'll end up doing it in the cytosol. Not only that, but they will be ready to go once they are finalized by translation and released. They'll fold up into the correct shape to do the job that they're supposed to do. So they won't need, in other words, any post-translational modification. We talked about post-transcriptional modification of mRNA, but there's also post-translational modification of polypeptides for certain polypeptides. If a polypeptide doesn't need any changes after it's produced by translation, if it's ready to go to do whatever job it is, then this is one of those ones that will start out and end up in the cytosol. There are other proteins, though, that will need to be modified. And now think back to what we said is the major job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Its job is to modify newly made proteins, right? And then package them and send them to the Golgi. So the cell needs to know whether any, what, if for any given polypeptide that's being built, the cell needs to know, is this going to be one that's ready to go on its own and should be finished here in the cytosol, or is this one of the ones that need to be modified and therefore we need to continue making this in such a way that it will end up in the lumen or the empty part of the endoplasmic reticulum. So there needs to be a way, obviously, for the cell to be able to tell whether a polypeptide is one that's going to be in need of modification or not. And it ends up that the polypeptide itself, or at least the beginning of that polypeptide, the first several amino acids that emerge while it's still being built, that sequence of amino acids that comes off first will serve as a signal to the cell that I am one of these proteins that's going to need to be modified. And you can see that as the three green amino acids here. It's not necessarily three amino acids, but it is in this cartoon. The fact that this is a particular sequence of amino acid tells the cell this is one that's going to need help. And so we call that sequence, which is just part of the overall polypeptide that's being built, we call that a signal peptide. Peptide is just a general word for meaning more than one amino acid, but not a hell of a lot, right? It's not a polypeptide, it's just a peptide, a small sequence of amino acids. Okay, so that, you know, is out in the cytosol on a free ribosome, because that's how that all starts out as. Well, remember, long ago, when I talked about signals in general, I said that they do nothing unless and until they bind to a receptor that can recognize the signal. Right? That signals are examples of ligands. Ligands are things that bind to other things. And so a signal operates as a ligand and has its effect by binding to a receptor. What kind of molecule is a receptor? Well, not a protein, right. Enzymes are very similar because substrates are also ligands. But proteins do one job as enzymes, and they're able to do that job well because they have just the right shape. Receptors are proteins for exactly the same reason. Proteins can have just the right shape, which is important for a receptor. It has to be a kind of a lock and key fit. All right? So there are such things as signal recognition particles, which are proteins, SRP. All right? There are different versions of this, not just one, just like there's not just one master enzyme. There's different signal recognition particles. Each type is able to recognize a certain signal peptide if it is emerging from the translation assembly line. And if it is, then there will be a binding of that signal peptide to the signal recognition particle. So notice that the signal recognition particle is operating, for the moment, as a receptor. And the signal peptide is acting as a ligand. Once that happens, then the consequence of that is that the whole translation complex, along with the signal recognition particle that is now added in itself to the mix, gets translocated via the cytoskeleton to the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which is the blue thing here. And this SRP, which just acted as a receptor, is now itself going to act as a ligand and be received by still another protein that will recognize the shape of the SRP. And that is called an SRP receptor protein. All right? So you have one protein, the SRP, recognizing the signal peptide, which is part of still another protein that's being built. And then that SRP is going to be recognized by another protein that is part of the membrane of the ER. It's one of the integral membranes. I mean, integral proteins of that membrane. And more specifically, it's not only integral, it is a transmembrane protein, sticks all the way through the surface, and it's a big complex of proteins forming a pore. The reason that it's important for it to form a pore is because for the ER to do the modification of this protein, whatever that modification is, you need to get that growing protein into the lumen. So by binding this SRP, which is carrying the whole translation complex, to the SRP receptor protein, that docks it in place in a perfect position so that the sequence of amino acids, the growing polypeptide, is going to be strung through that pore into the ER lumen. As it gets longer and longer, you can see that happening as more and more purple ones are being added here. All right? And depending on how that happens, the protein might be put entirely inside the lumen, or it might be stuck into the membrane. And depending on whether it's fully inside or it's in the membrane, when a vesicle is formed, it's going to be either inside that vesicle or part of the wall of that vesicle. If it's fully inside the vesicle, then it can be spilled entirely out of the cell. And if it's part of the vesicle wall, when that fuses with the plasma membrane, that protein will now be part of the plasma membrane. You see what I'm saying there? I think I might have a picture of that. Oh, I guess I don't. But that's how cells recognize whether a protein needs to be modified or not after translation. And what the modification is just depends on the individual protein. Like I said before, one example, just one of many examples, is that you might have to get rid of that methionine, because the methionine, which has to be there to get the process started, it might interfere with the ultimate shape that you want. So you cleave it off after translation. But other thing, you know, there's all kinds of modifications. You might have to add a sugar onto it to make it a glycoprotein, and so on. Plus, there are, remember, quaternary proteins as well. If you have a multimeric protein with quaternary shape, if you have one that's built out of not only multiple polypeptides, but multiple different kinds of polypeptides, like a hemoglobin, then you have two genes involved, right? For hemoglobin, you have a gene that codes for the alpha style and one that codes for the beta style. You need two of each, and then you have to package all four of them together. That's another post-translational modification. Okay, let's go on to 21. And speaking of hemoglobin, this is about mutation in the hemoglobin gene in one of these two genes involved. So we're not looking at nearly the entire gene here. We're just looking at one codon within the sequence. And the reason that we're paying attention to just one codon is because if a change takes place, and a change to a DNA sequence is a mutation, if a mutation affects just one nucleotide, or we sometimes call it a nucleotide pair, simply because, remember, there's two DNA strands, so if it's one position, it's still going to be a pair. One in one strand and the same position in the other strand. That's the simplest kind of mutation, called a point mutation, because it's just a single nucleotide in length. That's enough to make a difference, though, because the code is going to be changed, right? So remember I said that codons are really appropriately, that word is appropriately applied to RNA. RNA contains the codons. But, of course, there are corresponding places in the DNA that code for the codons, right? We sometimes use the word codon when we're talking about DNA as well. So this is what we have in the wild-type hemoglobin for one of the two kinds of polypeptides. It's supposed to be CTT on this top, And CTT is the part, is remember, a gene, I mean, transcription involves only one of the DNA strands, right? The coding strand, and the other one you just take out of the way. So CTT is the coding strand. And when that gets read in transcription, that's going to produce a codon in mRNA that's complementary to that, which is GAA. All right? So this is the messenger RNA. And then when you look up GAA in the genetic code, you see that it corresponds to glutamic acid, which is what GLU stands for. That doesn't matter that you memorize those. That's just that's the maintenance of the information, right? You have to put glutamic acid down there for the hemoglobin to have it the right shape to do its job in the body. Well, if you just have a point mutation, and instead of CTT, now you have CAT, then that means when it gets read, you're going to make a messenger RNA that is GUA. Because the cell doesn't realize the mutation is there, right? If it's made it past the error checking mechanisms that I've talked about before, then it doesn't know that it's an error anymore. Mutations persist because once they're in the DNA and they're allowed to be there, you can't tell that it ever has mutated. So the messenger RNA thinks it's doing the right thing, just obeying CAT to make GUA. GUA, when you look it up in the genetic code, does not correspond to glutamic acid, it corresponds to valine. So the rest of the amino acids in this whole long polypeptide are correct, exactly correct, even in the mutant. And the mutant here is a person with sickle cell disease. Only the one amino acid is wrong. But that makes enough of a shape difference when it folds up that it's not going to do the job of carrying oxygen and CO2 nearly as well like normal hemoglobin does. And this is why, well, I've said that before, so I'm not going to bother saying it again. Let's go to 22 and look at different kinds of mutation. Wild type, remember, is unmutated, which is, of course, false. Unmutated would mean the original piece of DNA. But of course, it's been mutated as well. Everything's been mutated over the course of billions of years. But wild type, compared to the other versions, is unmutated, and the others are called mutants. So you see the sequence we're interested in. This is what we were just looking at. Actually, it's a different example, but it doesn't matter. The two columns here, A and B, represent two different categories of mutations. These are point mutations because they're just small. There are also large-scale mutations that occur at the level of a chromosome, so a huge chunk of a chromosome carrying thousands or millions of nucleotides can actually move around. That's a big-scale change, and obviously that's going to have major, major effects. But these are point mutations. Even though they're all point mutations, though, we can categorize them differently. On the left, we have base pair substitutions. Substitution's a good word here because what happens here is that one of the nucleotides in the wild type sequence gets changed into a different nucleotide. I shouldn't say it gets changed into a different nucleotide. What I mean is that the wrong nucleotide gets put in its position. It gets substituted for it. And since it's a substitution, that means it's still the right length, right? Because what was supposed to be there has been replaced by something else. Still the same overall length of the sequence. That matters and doesn't cause as much of a difference in its effect than the right side, which are insertions or deletions. Substitutions do not change the length of the sequence. Insertions and deletions do. Insertions obviously occur when a nucleotide gets put in between two others that are already there. So an insertion will increase the overall length, and a deletion will be removal of one without replacing it with anything. So a deletion will make the overall sequence shorter. The reason that is such a big deal is because it messes with the reading frame. Remember we talked about why it's necessary for three nucleotides to stand for one amino acid? because 4 is fewer than 64. I mean, 4 is fewer than 20, right? If there were a one-to-one correspondence, if just one RNA nucleotide stood for one amino acid, then it wouldn't be as big a deal. But since 3 have to, that means a shift of just one nucleotide means you mess all the words up. For instance, if you use three-letter words, we use multiple different lengths of words, which we, by the way, know, we still have information because we know where words start and end. Not only when we speak, but especially in our writing, right? If we didn't use any spaces, it would be confusing as hell. A cell doesn't need any spaces between the words, though, because it knows every word is 3 letters long, a codon. So you can write a sentence like, the big rat ate the cat, we'll say. Extraordinarily big rat. If we know there are 3 letters, we don't need those spaces, right? If we substitute it, no huge deal. It does change things from big to bid, for instance, right? But the rest of these words are unchanged in the right position. On the other hand, if we insert one, like we put an A there, then it turns it into the bia, gra, tat, eth. You see what I'm saying? Every one of those words gets frame shifted. There's a frame of reference which is set by the codons, by that start codon. And that determines everything past it. So if you insert or delete, you're going to have a profound effect on the final product because it's not only going to change that amino acid, but all the others after that. All right? Now let's go back to base pair substitutions. It's possible for a substitution to have no effect at all. And the reason that it can have no effect is because of the redundancy of the genetic code. Right? Remember that 64 is more than 20, therefore you have more than enough amino acids to go around. Therefore you have multiple amino acids that code for the same kind of, multiple codons code for the same kind of amino acid. Therefore, if you just happen to mutate one codon into another codon that still specifies that same amino acid when you look it up in the genetic code, then it doesn't matter that the mutation happened, you still end up making exactly the correct sequence of amino acids, the same polypeptide. And that's why we call it a silent mutation. It is a mutation. You would notice it if you actually looked at the DNA, but it would be impossible to detect by looking at the protein because it's perfect. On the other hand, you can have a missense mutation. Missense means you're getting something wrong, right? So this happens when you change one codon into another codon that specifies a different amino acid, and that's exactly how that previous slide worked with the hemoglobin. Here, instead of glycine, you lay down serine instead. But if it's a substitution, only that one codon will matter, right? Because the rest of them will still be in the right reading frame, and so they will still be the right amino acid. This, by the way, is how natural selection and evolution works. Mutations happen randomly. Sometimes it's neutral because maybe the shape won't be changed enough for it to matter. Sometimes it's bad because now suddenly the function is disrupted, and if it's bad, then that organism will not survive well. Won't probably live long enough to reproduce and pass that new version on. Every once in a while, though, it does an even better job than the wild-type protein did. And those will be the mutations that are favored by natural selection because it'll give that organism an advantage. If it has a bigger chance of surviving to pass on its genes, it's going to be this new version that gets passed on, not the wild type. And so the next generation is overrepresented by this new version. Okay, so that's missense. And then nonsense is pretty much the same thing happening, meaning that you're changing one codon into one that codes differently. But in the specific case of nonsense, instead of changing it from a codon that corresponds to one amino acid to a codon that corresponds to another amino acid, You're changing it from a codon that codes for an amino acid into one of the three stop codons. And so the cell obeys stop wherever it gets it. Here in this case, though, it's going to stop prematurely. If it's only laid down a few amino acids and it thinks it's done, obviously that protein is not going to work for much, right? So that's a nonsense mutation. More severe in effect than a missense. Well, the insertions or deletions can work the same way. They're more profound in general because they affect the reading frame, like we were talking about. But also, they can actually result in a missense or a nonsense, depending on how things happen. 23. We see a polyribosome labeled on the top. We've already talked about that. And I told you that a polyribosome can exist in either a eukaryotic or a prokaryotic cell. But here we're looking at something that happens only in prokaryotic cells. This is not just one polyribosome. This is several polyribosomes, and each one, the mRNA that's in that polyribosome, has not even been completed yet. It's not even done being transcribed. This can't happen in a eukaryotic cell because transcription has to end in the nucleus before you modify the mRNA, before it can then go on to translation, right? But you don't have to go through with that trouble in prokaryotes because there's no nucleus, for one thing, that it has to get out of. It all transcription and translation happen in the same compartment, the cytoplasm. Moreover, the messenger RNA in a prokaryotic cell doesn't need to be modified. So as soon as you have enough messenger RNA hanging off of the DNA being transcribed still, for a ribosome to come and clamp onto it, you can have that still unfinished messenger RNA being translated into a protein. So the DNA here is this faint line right there. This is all one gene. Multiple different mRNAs are being transcribed in different parts of their completion. But before any of them is done, ribosomes are coming along and start the translation process before transcription ends. And so this really can speed up the building a lot of proteins at once, which is particularly important, by the way, in a unicellular organism. Because if you need a protein, you need it fast, or that cell will die. Well, if one of your 100 trillion cells dies, not the end of your life, necessarily. But if you lose the one cell that you are, that's a much bigger deal, right? So it's important that they can ramp it up. 24 is the last slide of the unit. And this really is no new information. This is review, but it makes sense to go through it quickly. This is obviously a eukaryotic cell, right? Because you have a nucleus in it. So, remember there are three steps to transcription, which is what's happening in this nucleus. What is the egg-shaped thing? You can cheat and look, but you should know what that is. It's RNA polymerase, right? So RNA polymerase is the master enzyme of transcription. It separates the two strands, recognizes which of those two strands is the coding strand. The non-coding strand just gets put to the side and ignored for a little bit. But the coding strand gets read one nucleotide at a time so that one complementary RNA nucleotide can be added one at a time to the mRNA that's being produced. And until the end of the gene is reached, that elongation just happens over and over. So you finally have the pre-mRNA. But the pre-mRNA, since this is a eukaryotic chromosome, that pre-mRNA needs to be post-transcriptionally modified by adding the poly-A tail and the 5' end, and also by splicing out the introns and sewing together the exons. When all that's done, you have the mature mRNA that is able to feed itself through one of those nuclear pores that are in the doubly membrane-bounded nucleus to get to the cytoplasm, which is where the ribosomes are. And this is a free ribosome, because remember, it starts out as a free ribosome always, that allows for initiation first, the binding of the messenger RNA to the small subunit, and the AUG corresponding tRNA carrying methionine as its amino acid, Then the large subunit comes along. You spend some GTP to do that. Then you one codon at a time instead of one nucleotide at a time. One codon at a time, you read the code and add the appropriate amino acid, which is brought in by the appropriate kind of amino acyl tRNA carrying that kind of amino acid, and corresponding with its anticodon to the codon in the A slot. Then it's, even though this picture ends there, it doesn't necessarily end there, right? Because translation is done, but you might have to modify that protein afterward, which is done by the endoplasmic reticulum. All right? Does that seem easier or harder than photosynthesis and cellular respiration? Easier?
Yeah, I'd say easier.
Good. All right, well, I'll see you in the laboratory.